As varied as our topography and soils, as rich as our resources, so varied and rich are the voices and stories of the folks around us. Come neighbor a bit with me, Sam Stroop. Grab a cup of coffee, pull up a comfy chair, let's get to talking. John and Kim Thompson have a small farm just out of town on the west side of Old Franklin. Theirs is a small, older farmhouse, a medium-sized barn, and other outbuildings. John has done major work on all of them, and they will serve and stand well through another generation. I'd invited them up one fall to use my 1870s cider press, and that was when I got to know John. He's seen a lot, knows a lot, and done a lot. What he's seen, he's learned from. What he knows, he loves to tell you about. And what he's done, he's always done very well. You don't stop in on John for just a few minutes. It's sit down by the wood stove with a cup of coffee and plan on doing some talking. When the daylight is long, it's walk the acres together and see the latest stuff he's been up to. I'm not surprised this recording session got really long. I've divided it into two parts. If you visit John's house, plan on spending some time. That's how it's going to be. So let's get to talking. Yeah, so John Thompson, you kind of strike me as having come from another planet down there where you were raised. Can you tell me a little bit about what that world down in the Ozarks was like when you were a kid?
Well, it probably wasn't a great lot like what people think it was like these days from watching TV and such, but it was a different world. Where I lived at, we didn't have electricity till I was 10 years old, so I was lucky enough not to grow up with a TV. I learned how to read with a kerosene light, and we got...
What year was the electricity come in then?
When we got it was about 1960.
Huh.
But other people around there had it quite a while before that. Mm-hmm. The reason why we didn't get it till then was because we lived off in a big deep holler, and they didn't want to run a line down there for one house.
You probably went from no electricity to a television then.
Well, actually, I think it was two or three years after that before we ever got a television.
Okay. There's no big rush on that one.
No, there wasn't any big rush. We didn't seem to miss it too bad.
How quickly did you get milking machines, or didn't you do that either?
When my older brother and sisters left home.
Oh, yeah.
We milked by hand until probably 65, 66.
Mm.
Milked between 15 and 25 cows.
How did you cool the milk? Spring water?
Spring and a wash tub and a milk stirrer.
Okay.
And that was how we done it. When I was real young, well, we got our drinking water out of a spring. It ran out of a cave up above the house. And my mother and sister carried the water down there and put it in big stone jars, crocks, what we used for a water bucket.
What county was this and what was the
Webster.
Town?
Webster.
And the nearest big
right
town.
Down in the southeast corner of Webster, where it joins Douglas and
what's the county seat?
County seat's Marshfield.
Okay.
I think I'm getting Alzheimer's here.
Yeah.
Down there in the corner where it joins Christian and Douglas County.
Okay.
My two.
How many acres did your dad
have? We had 120, but we rented about 500.
Wow.
And that was because everybody had moved out of there, and the country was full of old farms that were growing up in brush and empty houses. You could rent a place with a house on it, and the houses were usually livable for maybe $50 a year because there wasn't any demand.
Yep.
At the end of World War II, everybody moved out of there and went and got a job in town, and heirs and whatnot owned those farms or investors from away from there, and they just growing up brush. Some of them were pretty good and some of them weren't.
Did your dad have any debt? While you were growing
up? Yes, he was still paying on that farm when I was growing up. I think they gave $3,000 for that farm when I bought it. And they finished paying for that in the 60s, I think.
Yeah. So you're probably poor folk, but didn't know it because you had a good life.
We always had plenty to eat.
Yeah.
I know that.
Mm-hmm.
We worked like the devil. I mean,
yeah.
For real work. There's, you know, work is a relative thing.
Mm-hmm.
People go to an office and sit in front of a computer all day and come home and complain what a hard day's work they had. We used to do work where you got blisters and sweated while you done it.
Now, without electricity, you probably were milking cows in the dark by a kerosene lantern then.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And feeding cattle in the dark.
Yep.
And slopping the hogs in the dark in the winter.
We tried not to, but when you mm-hmm. know, when you go to school and whatnot, you always end up doing that.
Right.
We never ate supper until we had all the chores done, which mm-hmm. meant that we ate supper way after dark every night in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And usually not till about 9 or 10 o'clock in the mm-hmm. summer, because it never came in until it was after dark.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a habit I've had all my life. Kim and I don't eat at the same time because she's suburban raised and she likes to eat supper at 4 o'clock.
Right.
And I don't like to eat supper till about 7 or 8.
Yeah. Our family's that way too.
Yeah.
In the summer, we don't eat till 9 o'clock.
Yeah, all those things you grow up developing,
mm-hmm.
your taste and habits and whatnot, pretty well sticks with you.
Yeah.
Your life.
Is what's farming like down there now in Webster County? Or is there even any?
Yes, there's some. I'm kind of out on the loop on most of it because I haven't been around there much in the past 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's up there where I grew up, it's pretty well gone.
Okay.
That was mostly dairy farms.
Yeah.
Webster County was the number one dairy county when I was growing up.
Amazing.
Green County had been. That's the next county, Springfield, mm-hmm. to the west.
Yeah.
Green County was the number one dairy county for years, and it's kept moving east to cheaper, poorer ground all the time. The further east you get from Springfield, the cheaper and the poorer the ground gets. And people used to milk. I knew people that milked two cows and sold the milk.
Hmm.
And people, a big dairy farmer, would milk 40 or 50 cows.
Yeah.
And some of them had been doing it for generations, and some of those guys were really good. Some of them weren't so good.
Yeah.
Seen cows milked in everything from grade A milk parlors to out under an oak tree with a rope tied to the tree.
Yeah. So you're not certain, but there's not a lot of farming going on down there.
No, I think it's pretty well petered out in the land prices and everybody moving in there. And now, now that some of that ground around there that's pretty steep and rocky and
mm-hmm.
not farmland much at all, it was fair grazing ground, some of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that's higher priced than what cropland up here in North
mm-hmm.
Missouri is now.
Yeah.
Because everybody, all those refugees from success, moved mm-hmm. to the beautiful Ozarks and built a dream home when
mm-hmm.
they retired and whatnot. So that's what we got. We got overrun and inundated with outsiders.
So Webster County's full of rich people now.
pretty well, rich and poor. I think there's a I think there's no
in
much
between.
Middle anymore. I think they're either really poor or fairly well off.
Now, when did you leave the home farm? How old were you?
I had that farm myself until up in the 80s. I kept it for some time after I left down there. I always intended to go back and work an extension. Came up here to get an education, and it never worked out that way. So I finally tried renting it out for a few years, and that's something you don't want to do. That's a wreck.
So where was your college?
I done undergraduate work at Lincoln University and graduate school at University of Missouri.
Okay. And when did you start at Lincoln?
1984.
84, huh. And your major there was?
Animal science.
Animal science. How many kids at that time were studying agriculture at Lincoln?
Oh,
quite a few, or not many.
Yeah, more than you would think. I figure there was probably 30 or 40 more, something like that, considering if you counted natural resources and the plant science people and everything in there, there was probably even more than that. Mm-hmm. It was quite a few. A lot of those...
Well, what's the number you just gave me again? 30 or 40?
Yeah, at least. Might have been more than that.
All right.
Had a lot of those local kids down there that live in those small towns down there go there. Okay. And a lot of them major in agriculture, and they're really good, too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then had minority students, and they were usually coerced into majoring in agriculture, I think. They'd have an undeclared major, and their advisor would say, oh, you want to be a plant scientist. And so they'd get in that. Some of them done pretty good, and some of them didn't. And then we had a lot of international students.
What's some memories of some really good professors you had down there, or didn't you have any?
Oh, yes. The single best teacher, professor that I ever had, including grade school, high school, any of my university classes, was at Lincoln University, and was a plant science instructor, and it was a woman, and she was from Jamaica. Her name was Lurleen Marsh, and her husband worked there too. But she was, somehow or another, we just niched. I had probably four classes with her, three or four, and every one of them, that woman was, I could listen to her lecture all day. And probably retain every bit of it. She was outstanding. I think they left down there. From what I heard after I was there, I think they went off to some other university.
I suspect it because she was excited about plant science, and she was excited about teaching it to you.
She done research too, and she was really good at that. And actually, the very first class she had ever taught was the very first class that I was ever in with plant science, introductory plant science.
Wow.
She was just, I don't know how long they'd been there, but that was the first year that I was there. But she was just good. And I think that British education in Jamaica was part of it. Mm-hmm. And her voice, if you've ever been around those people from the Caribbean, her voice was just like music. You just sit there and listen to it and soak it up.
As I recall, they've got a real sharpness to their diction also.
Yeah.
And it is fascinating to listen to. You're right. There's a Jamaican lives in Fayette.
I've had some good instructors and some bad. But she was all around the best, the best instructor that I ever had anywhere at all.
But your actual major was animal husbandry.
Yeah, that's what I took a lot of plant science class. It's kind of a general agriculture class down there, but you kind of specialize. And then I worked as student labor down at the farm, so I got to do, actually because I was older and interested, I got to do a lot of things that other students didn't get to do. I helped a lot with reproductive physiology and the sheep and goats down there, mostly sheep. So I got to assist with a lot of surgeries and do a lot of things like that.
How old were you then when you started college at Lincoln?
33.
Okay. Well, now I know the secret as to why you got such a wonderful education.
Well, maybe wonderful education.
You were able to hit it very realistically.
I've given that a lot of thought since then. And I think it's one of the greatest mistakes there ever was sending kids to college right out of high school. I think they need to go do something for two or three years at least before they do that. Preferably get away from home and get out in the world a little bit, do something, and then go to university. Kids right out of high school, one thing, I think they're sick of school. That's all they've ever done in their life.
Yeah.
And most of them are immature, and they think they're just going somewhere to party.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a waste. They don't know what they're wanting to do.
Explain to me, it's been in the news a little bit about Lincoln saying we've been screwed out of a bunch of money in our extension program over the years, and we want that pile of money now. And I guess it's... Lincoln's a land-grant university like NU is?
Exactly.
And what does that mean?
Well, what land grant means, mm-hmm. I can't tell you much about them getting screwed out of the money. A fella did mention it to me that I know down there here a while back, but I can't tell you much about it because mm-hmm. I don't know anything about it. But the land grant university was, there's 1862s and 1890s. The 1862s, that's the years they were created. Okay. And University of Missouri is in 1862. And midway in the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln managed to push through two or three things that had never been able to push through because they didn't have the Southern senators up there. And one of them, they'd been pushing for government-funded schools to teach trades. Mechanical skills and agriculture mostly in all the states. And land grant is they funded those by giving federal owned land to the states to be sold to fund a state university to teach these skills. And each state got so much land granted to them to sell to finance the school. A lot of people think that that land grant means that the government gave them the land to put the school on, but it doesn't. The government gave them land to sell to finance the school. Okay. Some states didn't have any land to sell then, so they had a different deal. They got land from other places. Most of that land, like here in Missouri, they had the counties look it up. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've got books here that talk about when it was going on at the time. And that the land that wasn't taken up that the government still owned mm-hmm. was pretty sorry stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was down in counties. It was land, you know, most of Missouri had already been settled and whatever by then. So it was pretty sorry stuff, and that was kind of a give and take deal. That was the 1862s. The 1890s, after the Civil War, were black universities. And they eventually got around to funding them by land grant, and only a few states have two land grant universities, and they were black and white. Now, all 1890s were black. Lincoln University was started by regiments of ex-black soldiers at the end of the Civil War, and then it eventually got land grant status. Not all the states, I'm not sure how many 1890s land grant universities there are. I know Missouri and Georgia, Florida, probably all those states, Tennessee, Texas, I think Prairie View down in Texas is in 1890s.
Oh, I see.
They're not the majority of states at all.
Right.
And of course, after integration, don't have that anymore. Lincoln University has more white students than it does black now.
Mm-hmm. Now, wasn't part of the mandate then, all right, we're going to give you the land, form a college, but you have to also have an extension program.
The extension didn't come about until 1914.
Oh, okay.
And I think that was that the Hatch Act or the Morrill Act?
All right. Is it only the land grants that had the extension, though?
Yes, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they came up with the extension was because the universities were doing research and creating information, but it wasn't getting out to the public.
Okay.
And the only purpose for extension was to disseminate the information the universities were generating out to the public. Mm-hmm. Extension down through the years has changed quite a bit, but that was probably one of the single best investments that was ever made because extension at one time really done wonders, especially for agriculture. Mm-hmm. They've kind of got away from agriculture now. They're lapping over into other social services, I think.
Right. I'm noticing that in Howard County now. It's, family relations and all important stuff, but the emphasis is really strong in different directions. Is it, do you think, because people don't look to extension anymore for information on agriculture?
A big part of it is exactly that, and it's kind of... it's partly the university's fault, and it's partly the people's fault. But information has got, in extension's heyday, about the only place you could get good agricultural information was through the university, extension. Now people have access to it. The herbicide and seed feed companies put out probably more information to farmers than the extension does now.
Yeah.
And you have the internet. Everybody goes to the internet,
right,
for better or worse. Not everything you get off the internet is something you want to use, but they've kind of done that. And then the university itself kind of shot itself in the foot in a lot of ways. They put a lot of people out in an extension that probably should never have been there, and still do. So it's kind of one of those deals. I've been expecting the extension to die out, and the governor, Nixon, was going to cut it by 50% here a few years ago, and he had such an outcry from the 4-H mothers, them, the kids' programs, that he had to back off of that.
Okay.
That's one of the few big things. I think something like 60% of the extension's budget is spent on youth programs.
Huh.
And that was a few years ago, the last I knew.
Wow.
Now that's their big forte, and that's the only thing that keeps them in business probably now.
Now, you went then to the university for master's in what?
Agronomy.
Agronomy.
And forages.
And you said that you, at one time had the dream of going back to Webster County as an extension worker.
That's right.
And was that part of why you went on with the master's program?
Yeah, it was. And my plan was, I had worked for the state sheep and goat specialist, extension specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, even while I was in undergraduate student, when I was down at Lincoln, and then after that, I worked for her, and when I
was that Helen
Swartz, and I quit her to go there because I had this idea that I done a lot of work around in Missouri with mostly sheep and goat people, but in some other states too. My experience is the animal science people are pretty good at animal science. They don't know a thing about what the animals eat, and in Missouri that's forages, and the forage people could care less about the animals that have to eat the forage usually. And I thought, well, you know, old John, I'll just be the best one there ever was around. I'll merge these two things because I was interested in both of them.
Right.
And so that was my plan. And when I got through the graduate degree, I applied for extension. They pretty well told me to go to the devil. They didn't want nothing to do with me. I don't know if it was my age, because I'm mouthy, or exactly what it was, but that didn't work out.
So your line of work then became what after you got your master's?
Well, I worked for my advisor in forage research. Actually done a lot of work with native plants then with him, and forage research for some time, and then I went to work for the state entomologist, and then we done plot work with corn and soybeans mostly around over the state, and then I had to have surgery on my neck, and I was off for a year, and I didn't know if I'd ever go back to work or not, but then I got hired by the agroforestry people who have the deal here at New Franklin, and I finished up working the rest of my time there with a little bit of everything, but partly with trees. I done quite a bit of work with warm season grasses when I worked with them, and shade studies, those kind of things, and then I retired.
In that line of work, which sounds like it's about 25 years of research and playing with plants and watching plots grow, and what were some things that, I don't know if the right word would be, that you're really proud of or you found really intriguing and saw some success at, or what were some positive moments or seasons?
I had like three projects that I more or less dreamed up and designed and done all the work on, actually. One of them was a cowpea study with finishing lambs on it down at Lincoln University, and I've done that for like 5 years, where we fed out lambs on cowpeas.
Yeah.
And that was probably one of the best projects that I ever done. That was really good.
Did you have a feeling that it was going to be a good thing or maybe this is a good thing, let's try it. You know what I'm saying?
Actually, I had done quite a bit of it on my own before I ever went to university. I had grown cowpeas and raised sheep on them and raised some hogs on cowpeas. I used to finish hogs on pasture, rape and cowpeas and such. And that was a crop that used to be used a lot, but has fallen away by the wayside now. People don't really, we pretty well just grow fescue.
Right.
Corn and soybeans now. But those cowpeas are a wondrous plant. They do well on poor soil. They do well with low rainfall, droughty soil. And when it's hot and dry, they do well. And they're better than alfalfa and protein. And they're palatable. They don't cause any digestive problems to speak of. And they're really something that ought to be used more. 5 years of research for that. All the data and whatnot, and it never was published.
Wow.
You can't really find it anywhere now, which kind of bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
The other project, I had an interest in native legumes for years, and when I went to graduate school, I told my advisor I wanted to work with those, and he was all for it, but we couldn't. Had to get the funding from the conservation department, and I couldn't do my graduate degree. Start out with that because I didn't know if I could get it funded. But that was mainly what I done during graduate school, was work with those native legumes, but that wasn't my graduate thesis work. Mm-hmm. My graduate thesis work was with fescue and the endophyte, because everybody was getting funding for that at the time.
Right.
But I traveled all over Missouri and collected germplasm from the wild for all of these native legumes and grew them out in... started them in greenhouse and plants and grew them out in plots out at Bradford Farm and up here at New Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And worked with those for like 6 or 7 years. First time that all of them have ever been really treated that way in the state of Missouri, and that was for the conservation department. We printed up a big final report, book form, everything about it. Turned it in to the conservation department, and now nobody can find it.
Wow.
So much for good research. All these years that I've done in research, nobody can find.
Yeah.
Really, really makes you feel good. Conservation department spent over $100,000 on that project over a period of like 5 or 6 years. And I've had 2 or 3 people that work the conservation department mention it. And I said, yeah, we done that. Didn't you ever hear that? Oh, no, I didn't know that. They go look for it. Nobody has any idea whatever became of it.
Can you even explain what was going on? Because to me, these both the things you've just described sound so brilliant. But apparently, I don't know what happens.
That's a good question. More of that happens than you might imagine. The lady, that was the state extension specialist that I done that research with the cowpeas for, and she never would. She'd put out newsletters about stuff. There's probably, in some of her old newsletters, there's some things about those cowpeas. Before there's any published papers or anything that you'll find anywhere, probably not, because she never would publish anything. And they told me that the reason why she never would publish anything is she tried to publish a paper one time and they turned her down. It made her mad and she would never try again. Something like that. I don't know if that's true or not, but it never got published.
Well, you know, to me, I wonder if it's a little bit of this. There's something I call real farmers. And I'm not sure they're really farmers, real farmers, but they're the real farmers. And real farmers don't raise goats, and real farmers don't raise sheep. And I tell them, hey, first February I sold wethers for $3.17 a pound. Now, you stack that up against cattle, but they don't even hear what I say because they're real farmers, and real farmers don't raise goats. And real farmers don't raise cowpeas. They put nitrogen on fescue.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I mean, that's fairly apparent. And a big part of that is status. in America, we do things primarily for status.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't very many years ago to where you was just pretty well white trash if you kept goats here in Missouri. Now, in Texas and the Edwards Plateau is different. In most states, most areas, you was low rent person if you kept goats.
Yeah.
And so nobody wanted to do that, you know. So they, you couldn't get them, and sheep was the same way. And I worked out a deal. I used to show students, used to do some classes, and I'd say, you know, the hierarchy of agriculture in the United States is it starts out up here is the horse people, but not just any horse people. Those Arab horses that doctors and lawyers and movie stars have, and they get together once a year for a week and sell back and forth to each other. That's top of the line. You work your way down through the horses, but you don't ever get down to the Amish draft horses because that's work and that's peasant type stuff. You go from horses to beef cows. And if you're a beef cow man, you're a rancher now. Used to be they were farmers in Missouri, but now they're ranchers. And that allows you to wear cowboy boots and a hat and go to the coffee shop in the morning and talk cow. You work your way down from that, you get into dairy cows, and that's kind of low rent because that's kind of peasant farming, and you have to get out there and wade manure and whatever, and you might wear the boots and whatever, but you're not really considered a real cattleman. You're a peasant farmer. And hogs are the same way, but they're just a little below dairy cows. And then you work down to the sheep people. Poultry people are in there between the hogs and the sheep. You get down to the sheep people, and they're okay, but you really don't want to admit you know them out in public or anything like that. And they're certainly not part of the gang where you go to the coffee shop. You know, they're sheep people.
Yeah.
And then you go below that, and you've hit rock bottom. You get down to the goats, they're just unspeakable, you know. And that's the hierarchy of American agriculture.
Yeah.
That's how it works out.
Yeah, interesting. a couple questions on the cowpeas, and just so people can get an idea of what was going on. And maybe you don't remember all the numbers, but okay, so you plant the peas when?
Well, after frost.
Okay.
They're a tropical plant.
Hmm.
Native to Africa and the Middle East.
See, I wait till middle of May?
Middle of May, okay. Or late May.
And how fast do they grow up to where you can start pasturing?
Generally, if it's a good spring, you can probably start grazing them along about, I'd say 6 weeks after that. Month maybe, but six right. weeks at least.
First of July.
The thing is, if... you rotate, and that's something that I proved because I had already done that at home. We had a plant guy working with us on this, and he told me that I was crazy, but I said, we can rotate those sheep on that and it'll regrow. And he said, no, it won't regrow. Those are herbaceous plants. When they're cut off, I said, nah, they'll eat the leaves off, and if you don't graze them too close, they've got a bud in the leaf axle, and they'll regrow. And they did. And we used two different types. One was a new experimental type from the Caribbean. It came from Africa. And one was the old California black eye. There used to be endless varieties of them, but that's kind of reduced now. The black eyes were more viney, and they produced bigger pods and beans. But in comparing the two, there really wasn't any difference with the lambs gained. We never fed those lambs one single thing but cowpeas. Let them graze cowpeas, and I rotated them. And it was fairly dry summers. One of those years was a drought year, in fact. But if I rotated them right, let that regrow, I was able to graze right up until frost killed the cowpeas.
So because you were rotating them, and it was sheep or goats on them, probably didn't have to worry about weed control at all because the sheep would eat the weeds down too.
Yeah, they did, but I did cultivate them one time
okay.
with a small tractor cultivator, But if you've done a good job planting them, you wouldn't have to worry about that unless you had toxic weeds in there. That'd be okay. Something to worry about if you had something that caused bloat or something.
And any idea what seed cost would be for an acre?
Yeah, that's probably the single biggest drawback to that, mm-hmm. because the seed was kind of prohibitive. I think the black eyes were like $1 a pound then, but they'd be higher now. But black eyes are not the best ones to grow for that. And I saw on the internet here a while back where you can get some of the older varieties like whippoorwills and some of them that might be better. And if you can buy it bulk, the black eyes are the ones that you eat human mm-hmm. food, and that kind of keeps yeah. the price seed up. But you really don't have, if you've got medium fertility soil, mm-hmm. you really don't have to fertilize them, but you sure want to inoculate them good, and you inoculate them with Lespediza inoculum. Same inoculum for both of them. And if you rotate that right and you don't have too horrible a summer, you can graze till the frost kills them. Mm-hmm. And they'll keep regrowing right up till then. They stand drought good. They don't have...
How many pounds to the acre? You said it was about $1.
About a bushel. Okay. A bushel a pound and, or a bushel a mm-hmm. acre. And I was trying to think about what... I think they're about like corn as far as weight per bushel. It would cost you about, back then, it would cost you about $50 or $60 a acre for seed.
Now, what kind of rate of gain do you think you were getting? The size of the animal you were putting on in the first of July.
Those were, actually, I've got all the data in there, mm-hmm. the original data. I'm trying to think here. Those lambs, and we had a problem getting lambs that were uniform. We had to buy those lambs two or three different places, sure. so we had some white face and some black face, which I never did like. Those lambs weighed about 50 pound when mm-hmm. we put them on those cowpeas, and they were mixed sex, wethers and ewe lambs both. And we got about a half a pound a day gain on mm-hmm. them, if I remember right. They never had anything, nothing but cowpeas.
Yeah.
And we grazed them, and we also done carcass work on them. To see if they had a grassy flavor or not. The University of Missouri Meat Science place done the carcass work, and they done some papers on that.
The nice thing is, you're grazing that stuff when fescue just sucks.
Yeah, that was a good thing about it.
You can't get rate of gain at all on fescue that time of year.
I collected samples from those cowpeas every week, mm-hmm. and later on ground them and got them analyzed and whatever, and I think they ran about, if I remember right, somewhere around 20% protein.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I always wish we'd have done a little different, because those lambs were converting protein to energy, which is a wasteful process.
Right.
If you'd supplement them a little corn for energy,
sure.
you'd get a lot better use out of that protein than that.
And quarter pound a head? A day
probably
would be all it takes.
You'd get a lot better gains, and you'd be able to graze more on mm-hmm. on the cowpeas,
right?
And you wouldn't be making all the gains off of protein.
Can you see that working at all for cattle though? Putting them on cowpeas for fat for good gains.
Yeah, they'd gain fine on it. I don't know how economical it would be when you compared mm-hmm. it with things like orchard grass or things like that.
What would you do, they're gone after frost, which is 1st of October anymore, sometimes later. What would you do after that as a follow-up? Anything?
Yeah, I'm a great believer in mullable crop stuff, and I think you could probably go in there before you quit grazing it mm-hmm. and broadcast something like forage rye on the ground.
Yeah.
And maybe let the sheep tromp it in.
Okay.
But you could probably go ahead and dig it up, disc it. The ground's been in pretty good shape after those, about like after soybeans. Mm-hmm. You could probably, after you tuck the sheep off after frost, you could probably disc in the rye, you would not waste as much seed. But I'm wondering if it was the right kind of fall, if you couldn't get a pretty good stand or something like that, and just broadcasting it on top of the ground, letting the sheep.
Now, what about if mid-September to 1st of October, mid-October, are the cowpeas really growing much? Should you maybe just go in there and tear them up anyway?
They have slowed down, yeah. You probably could.
Probably just tear them up anyway.
And if you fed a little corn where you got the right kind of gains off those lambs, it would probably be profitable. And you're getting the nitrogen out of those cowpeas, which they're big nitrogen fixers.
They're pretty good at setting on nitrogen.
They're every bit as good as soybeans.
Wow.
And we compared them with later on with soybeans, mm-hmm. and with alfalfa,
yeah.
and with sedan grass, mm-hmm. sorghum sedan grass.
Yeah.
We had to end the sorghum sedan grass study early because we were starving the sheep to death. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't, and,
yeah.
you know, they had plenty to eat, but there just wasn't anything there.
Right. Now, what about, did you both plant in rows and drill, or...
We planted in rows with a corn planter.
Okay.
But you could drill. You wouldn't want to plant them real thick. These things get big. But you could do it either way. Used to be at home.
So are they 30-inch rows or 36?
Probably 36.
Okay. And that's still they spread out.
Oh yeah, they cover the ground.
So it allowed you to cultivate once if you wanted to.
Yeah. Those black eyes, especially when it's muddy and the sheep mm-hmm. are in there and they make long, almost vining stems, mm. sheep trump them down the mud and they'll take root there. Mm. They will, mm-hmm. you know, they keep kind of like sugar cane ratoons, I guess, but I wouldn't count on that doing that, but it does do it some. Mm-hmm. Those sheep, when we done the alfalfa ones took off and left the others at first, but something really unusual happened there about August, and it wasn't because the alfalfa got old and tough, because we were mowing it mm-hmm. and rotating it, so it was always the same growthy stage. Those sheep just quit gaining on that mm-hmm. alfalfa, mm-hmm. and that's always been a mystery to me, and I've never figured it out why, but they did. And we had the soybeans and the cowpeas then we were comparing, and the cowpeas done better than the soybeans by some. I think the cowpeas are actually more palatable.
Next session, we'll be talking about what he had been up to while employed at the University of Missouri Agroforestry Research Center here in Franklin. We'll be ruminating on government agricultural policies in the U.S. and elsewhere, and how well they have or haven't worked, and just various and sundry observations on other stuff going on around us. So be sure to tune in.